Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello, my book of the week this week is Home by Marilyn Robinson. It's not just my book of the week, of course, because it's just won the Orange Prize. It's the story of the Boughton family and is a companion piece to her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Gilead. Welcome, Marilyn.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Will you tell us just a little bit about this new book?
Well, Home is about the return of two adults, two adult siblings to their father's house. Both of them, both Jack and Glory, have had a difficult experience in the outside world and have come home for separate reasons. Glory has been taking care of her father, and then her brother Jack, who has really disappeared for 20 years, reappears, and she and he reestablish a brother and sister relationship while they care for their father, and while Jack at least tries to work out the problem that has brought him home.
And it has a very particular voice, doesn't it? I wonder whether you could give us an indication of that voice by doing a little bit of reading for us from the opening section.
All right. This is Glory ruminating on the fact of having been returned to her hometown, which was not a thing that she had anticipated or hoped for. The town seemed different to Glory now that she had returned there to live. She was thoroughly used to Gilead as the subject and scene of nostalgic memory. How all the brothers and sisters, except Jack, had loved to come home, and how ready they always were to leave again. How dear the old place and the old stories were to them, and how far abroad they had scattered. The past was a very fine thing in its place, but her returning now to stay, as her father said, had turned memory portentous. To have it overrun its bounds this way and become present and possibly future too, they all knew this was a thing to be regretted. She rankled at the thought of their commiseration. Most families had long since torn down their outbuildings and sold off their pastures. Smaller houses in later styles had sprung up between them in sufficient numbers to make the old houses look increasingly out of place. The houses of Gilead had once stood on small farmsteads with garden patches and berry patches and hen houses, with woodsheds, rabbit hutches, and barns for the cow or two, the horse or two. These were simply the things life required. It was the automobile that changed that, her father said. People didn't have to provide for themselves the way they once did. It was a loss. There was nothing like chicken droppings to make flowers thrive.
Yes, there is a deep melancholy, which I think shows in that. And it's very interesting to hear you reading it yourself. It was described by Sarah Churchwell in Review as one of the saddest books I have ever loved. Is this deliberate?
I seem to have a history of writing sad books. It's really never my intention when I sit down to do, you know, with my characters. But I think that anything that is emotionally weighty that people deal with in their lives has at least a tincture of sadness in it. It's part of the music.
Mm. It's people have pointed out that it's actually much sadder than Gilead. Will you talk a little bit about the relationship between these two books, which have appeared a year apart, which is very close for you?
It is. I wrote Gilead first. It's the story of a minister who has married late, a minister in Gilead, Iowa, who has married late and has a young son, and has begun to know that he will not live much longer. He's an elderly man. He is writing the book as if to his son, for his son to read when he is old enough, when he's an adult. And so it stays very much within that point of view necessarily and follows the sort of thinking and memory that are characteristic of this elderly clergyman. He has a very good friend, another clergyman named Reverend Boughton, who has a very large family and so on, in many ways has seemed to him to have a very enviable life, with the one exception of this most adored son, Jack, who is a thorn in his father's heart, misfeasances have inspired the theology of his father, in effect, which is a continuous effort to understand and to forgive him.
Now, they're set in exactly the same period of time. It's the same story told from two different perspectives.
Yes, it is. It is. Yes, it's completely simultaneous, the action of the two novels.
And it's 1956.
Yes.
Why have you chosen to set it in 1956?
Well, there are various things. I like to set things back in time because I don't like the idea that people can be interrupted, interfered with, that their thinking is overlaid by continuous advertising and that sort of the things that do tend actually to be kind of the conspicuous elements of contemporary culture. And then also a great deal was happening in America in that period. It was the beginning of the civil rights movement. And I was limited by the fact that I wanted the narrator of Gilead to have known someone who was actually involved in abolitionism and the Civil War. And that was his grandfather. I had to make Ames a late child in his own family and so on. But time constraints were present from that point of view.
And letters obviously feature they're very important in it, aren't they?
Yes.
It begins with a letter arriving from Jack announcing his return, and then at various stages there are letters which, to a certain extent, dictate the pace of the plotting.
Yes, that's true. Yes. I think that, I mean, people do use the telephone and so on, but it's not their first impulse, you know. And they're still aware of each other's handwriting, for example, you know, the character that is so perhaps reflected in how people choose to communicate to each other in writing.
Mm-hmm. Now let's move on to the big thing, which marks it out from almost every other novel that I've read in the last few years, is the religion, the centrality of religion to it, mm-hmm. or of scriptural debate, certainly.
Yes, well, those are interests of mine. I am very interested in theology, and I think that the great issues of religion are actually legitimately major issues. How what is causality? How does time unfold? You know, these are really the questions that lie behind questions like predestination. The answers that religion or science have ever arrived at are never satisfactory, but that does not by any means diminish their value as questions.
Mm. This is a Presbyterian community.
Yes, it is. Yes, Presbyterian Congregational.
Mm-hmm. And are you, is that your religious background?
I was more or less Presbyterian as a child, and I became a Congregationalist as an adult. And the change is so subtle that most people would have to spend their lives trying to exactly define it. Nevertheless, I am a Congregationalist and not a Presbyterian.
you've taken Dawkins to task, haven't you, for his ignorance about these sort of subtleties?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, I it's interesting. There's a genre, of course, that Dawkins is one voice in, and it tends to declare enormous competence in many fields, you know. I think that perhaps the claim that they make is not totally justified.
So, in a way, this is the story of a prodigal son. It is a rewriting of the prodigal son.
In a way, it is. It is, with major changes. I mean, for one thing, the prodigal narrative in this case happens on a human landscape. The prodigal not only comes home, but he stays. You know, I mean, we sort of know what happens after the joyful greeting, or even that there's a sense of tears in the joyful greeting itself. You know, that as human beings in a non-parabolic reality, things are simply more shadowed and complex.
Mm-hmm. Now, and for the first time with this, you're not using first-person narrative. Gilead was narrated by John Ames.
Mm-hmm.
Is this an important departure?
Well, you know, it's how the voice presented itself. I think that, for one thing, Ames actually is writing. That's the given of the book. And so it seemed as if it would be artificial to create a first person who is simply speaking. I mean, there's something very natural about using a first person when the writer, supposedly, is the I, you know. And then also there's something about the character of Glory. She's reserved, you know, and opaque to a certain degree.
She talks about the fiancé, I know.
Yes,
very,
exactly.
It's very poignant.
Yes.
Who once existed.
Yes. Yes. So that not to be absolutely in her head seemed more logical to me.
Mm. And it's taken you how long has it taken you to write these? You've written three novels over a period of 30 years.
Yes, more than the national average.
So why did it take you so long? I'm really interested in the huge gap between Housekeeping, your first novel, right, particularly, and Gilead.
Well, I've always had a little trouble with, you know, what seemed to be the contemporary, you know, the articulation of contemporary experience is never persuasive to me. And it seems to me as if it's full of things that overdetermine interpretation, how you're supposed to see the suburbs or how you're, you know. I happen to have grown up in a remote, very little visited at that time part of the country. And that gave me the possibility of having my own landscape, my own vocabulary of experience and so on. And that was very satisfactory to me. But I didn't want to do it twice. I didn't want to be limited. And in a way, in order to feel that I could, you know, write out of my own sense of reality, I read a great deal just in order to sort of re-equip my mind so that I didn't feel as if I were one more voice echoing a sort of cultural consensus that was not really credible to me.
And you were teaching at the same time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Teaching writers.
Yes.
Which is interesting. I mean, is that a draining thing to do if you're a writer yourself?
Well, I'm fortunate to teach in a very good program in Iowa, and we can, you know, we attract very interesting young writers. And so there's a lot of stimulation in it, actually, and a lot of interesting discussion that's generated by the young writers themselves. I think it's been a big advantage to me, actually.
Mm. Now, I'm really interested in this paradox that I think I see in your writing, which is between the historic setting, or it almost feels out of time slightly, the biblical reference. And yet, now I'm going to quote from your essay on Dawkins. You talk about the tectonics of culture are suddenly active and all the old rifts and stresses and pressures that seem to have fallen dormant have awakened at once with a great deal of portentous rumbling and spouting. Now, I feel very much that you're absolutely aware of this rumbling and spouting and your novels are charged with them.
I suppose that's true. I have felt that religion is not well represented. I mean, I don't know why, but there's an awkwardness in the, you know, it's always as if people, on the basis of being religious, have, you know, a set of dogmas that they adhere to in some sort of psychological dependency or something like that, as if they've sort of given up on the experience of life because they have seized upon these certainties keep the terror of life away. You know, that's how it's represented when it's represented in a negative way. And it seems to me as if there are very few voices that say, no, that's not actually the experience at all. You know, it can make people it can make people daring in a way. It can make people think about themselves and the issues that they encounter in a much larger frame of meaning than other modes of thought can provide.
Mm. So you are challenging the new orthodoxy.
Well, I am. I have to. You either share an orthodoxy or you challenge it, I guess. And it's not my orthodoxy, you know.
You've also done that in essays, haven't you? I know you wrote rather intriguingly about the British nuclear industry. How
yes.
did that come about?
Well, I was living in Canterbury in 1983 and 1984, teaching at the University of Kent. And I started reading these things that were just in the newspapers, you know, and seeing things on television and so on. And I was amazed. I was amazed. So I felt as if it were something that deserved attention and also needed to be thought about, because I was really quite surprised that something at that scale and of that kind could go on in a major advanced country.
Will you be doing more nonfiction, or are you sticking to novels for the time being?
I have no idea. I actually did a series of lectures at Yale University that I have some work to do before I want to submit them to their press. They will publish them. And that's my immediate future.
And the next novel?
I'm thinking about things that feel novelistic, and we will see. I hope I die before I write a novel that I'm not fully committed to.
But it won't be another 24 years, presumably.
No, I'm not that optimistic.
Well, you've certainly got an awful lot of readers here who will be waiting with bated breath for the next one, and I wish you very good luck with it, and thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.